Aloha, everybody. Welcome to Health Talk. And this is Dr. Donna Kaplan. And we've got Dove here in the studio helping. Couldn't do it without you, Dove. How are you?
All right. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. We have a really exciting show, another exciting Health Talk show. We've got a really wonderful guest, Dr. Alan McDaniel, MD, board-certified ear, nose, throat doctor and integrative medicine doctor from Louisville, Kentucky. So are you with us there, Dr. Alan McDonald?
I am. Mahalo. How are you, Donna?
Mahalo. Very good. Very good. And welcome to Kauai. Thanks so much for calling all the way from Kentucky. How are you?
My fingers do the walking on that one.
Yeah, I wish you were in the studio.
So do I.
But this is the next best, so it's really a pleasure to have you join us today. And we're going to be covering a couple of topics: insulin sensitivity and thyroid health. So tell us, Dr. McDaniel, tell us about your experience and what has brought you to where you are today.
Well, thank you. My wife says I've been Miyagi'd by life going through my medical training. I spent a couple of years doing general surgery in one of the nation's first trauma centers. And kind of burned out. I went to emergency medicine for a couple of years, trained at Georgetown, and then switched to ear, nose, and throat because I missed surgery, frankly. Mm-hmm. And the ear, nose, and throat switch was very important for me because it made a transition from acute blood and guts to chronic brain teaser puzzlers. A lot of ear, nose, and throat is chronic, and you have to think about what are the causes before you can get rid of the problem. So that enabled me to look and learn how to treat allergy, and allergy led me to chronic fatigue, and chronic fatigue led me to endocrine problems.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of that, I learned that the majority opinion of doctors is usually very good for the majority of patients, but there are a minority of people who are better served by a different approach, a sort of a minority report for medicine, a different way of doing things. And that has led me to integrative medicine, where we try to put together ideas and practices from not only all medical specialties, but all health practitioners to come up with a better solution for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I imagine as an ear, nose, throat doctor, you saw a lot of chronic inflammation, chronic sinusitis, ear infections, and that's what led you to the allergies, huh?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was pretty good with my hands, and so I decided to specialize in ear surgery, and I was able to get one of only six positions in the country at the time in a field called neuro-otology, which deals with dizziness, inner ear problems, and, of course, lots of chronic ear disease. And the mastoid is a sinus, just like the maxillary or frontal or ethmoid sinuses. So in dealing with chronic mastoiditis, you also have patients who have chronic sinusitis, and the allergy work was really important for those guys.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you much better. You know, when you operate, it's you cannot put a better ear in there than the creator put there in the first place. And unless you've gotten rid of the cause of the problem, you're not going to have a good long-term outcome with that surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really pushed me to find the best treatment for allergies and nutritional problems. And that got me into an almost naturopathic approach. You know all about that.
Mm-hmm,
giving just the right amount of what the body needs, not 10 times more, And that enabled me to be pretty good with hormones when I was led that direction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also, of course, with naturopathic medicine, we're looking at the root cause, and it sounds like that's what you've been dedicated to, you know, looking at and treating.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, if there's a water stain all along the upper part of my wall, you know, I could paint it or put up new wallpaper, but it really makes sense to fix the leak in the roof first.
Right, right. Absolutely. Especially with mold. You don't want to just paint over it. That'll come through pretty quickly, won't it?
Yeah. Oh, don't get me started on molds.
I know. I imagine you see a lot of patients in your private practice that have mold issues. As well.
I really do. We live in the Ohio River Valley, and you know, I went to medical school in Louisiana. New Orleans is surrounded by water on all four sides, and so molds and I are old enemies.
Yeah, we actually have a lot of rainfall here on most areas on Kauai.
Yeah.
And so we definitely have a lot of mold here, and people who have developed sensitivities here too.
That's rough stuff. You guys are lucky to have the trades 50 weeks of the year. I know the 2 weeks when they start blowing is pretty tough on everybody with allergies, but it does help to keep the air moving.
Mm-hmm. It does. It does. We have an added issue. Have you ever heard of VOG? V-O-G? So this is the gas from the Big Island
from the volcano.
From the volcano.
Holy
so when smokes. The when the wind blows from the south, we can get quite a bit of that coming over. Of course, not as bad as other islands like the Big Island and Maui, but we do get it, and so we do have a lot of allergy problems, sinus issues, lung issues that come from that.
You know, they did a study in Indiana years ago. They looked at kids who had a wood stove and compared them to a large group of kids with any other kind of heat.
Right.
And they looked for 3 years, and the kids with a wood stove, products of combustion, were three times more often in the doctor's office over that 3 year span. And I can imagine volcanoes strike me as emitting products of combustion.
So why don't we get into talking about insulin resistance?
That's a great topic. Yeah. So important these days.
And so we definitely have an epidemic here in this country with obesity and insulin resistance, right?
You know, if you really look at every one of the health problems that is increasing in our nation, really insulin resistance is behind every one of them. Obesity, hypertension, diabetes, sleep apnea syndrome, PCOS for women, hypogonadism, low testosterone for men. It's absolutely amazing. And I think the reason is that so many of us have the genetic predisposition to insulin resistance. We're living a modern American lifestyle with the standard American diet, the acronym for is SAD. And we basically, it's just like leaning into a punch into our jaw. We're absolutely not protecting ourselves from it. Mostly because most people don't know what to do. So I'm so glad we can talk about it today.
It's so important. And why don't you first describe what is insulin resistance? And and also, you know, I think a lot of people know about diabetes and they're not really understanding about insulin resistance. And so if you want to talk about that.
Well, in the first place, insulin resistance in the millennia past has actually been really good for the human race. And that's why 40% of all Americans and, you know, more than 50% of a number of ethnic groups, including Polynesians, have insulin resistance because it kept people alive during times when food ran short. You know, in ancient times, we couldn't go to the grocery store. There was no canned or smoked or even dried food. The wealth of an organism was the amount of fat they were carrying in their body. That would get them through bad times. And even in present day, You know, some societies think fat's where it's at. And so sometime before the human race split up into races, because everybody, all races have at least some form of this gene, one of our ancestors developed a mutation that made him or her fuel efficient, less likely to die of starvation, able to live longer when the food ran out, and that person's children could have kids at a slightly younger age, so it gave them a reproductive advantage, and the babies that were delivered were larger, so they had a survival advantage, and those bigger babies grew up into bigger, stronger people, so their tribe had a competitive advantage, and this was all good. It's so all good that, like I said, across the board, 40% of all Americans are thought to carry this gene.
Right. I mean, really, but, back, you know, in those conditions where there are famines and such, they would be the only ones that would survive, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, if, and it wasn't just like the Donner Party when you're snowed into the past. If you think the Maya civilization fell when there was a humongous drought, sometime around, what was it, AD 800? And so it's not a big surprise that more than 50% of Mexican Americans are insulin resistant. And in fact, in the American Southwest, the Pima people, more than 70% of them are insulin resistant. African Americans had to survive the most cruel crossing of the Atlantic and starvation conditions. So it's no surprise more than half of African Americans of insulin resistance. And then, you know, the Polynesian people, it wasn't always paradise, and these guys had to make it across, you know, thousands of miles of ocean in a canoe. If you had a fast metabolism, you might be going down. And so it's the geneticists call this the thrifty gene, but because of the changes in the American diet and the lifestyle and our nutrition, the thrifty genes are killing us now.
So you said 40% of Americans carry this gene, huh?
Yeah, that's that. There was a nice review article of this in JAMA back all around 2003 based on the National Health and Nutrition Evaluations Survey, NHANES-3. Mm-hmm. And, you know, working with the statistics, they thought that up to 40% of Americans could show this. And I think it's more than a coincidence that, you know, some 35% of Americans are now obese. Most of the people who are obese in our country are insulin resistant. They're vulnerable because they've got the thrifty gene. You know, you give them a calorie, they're going to keep it.
Right.
And the thrifty genes are causing the sleep apnea and obesity and diabetes. They're causing the hypertension and kidney disease, heart attacks and strokes. They're causing the PCOS, menstrual problems, and infertility. How many married, young married couples now have fertility problems? It's getting to be amazingly high. It causes low testosterone in men. It reduces our quality of life. It reduces our medical, our lifespan. You know, they say insulin resistance is the cause of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, people make plenty of insulin. It just can't work. And this same JAMA review of the NHANES data said that when an American becomes diabetic, he is or she has shortened his life by between 10 and 14 years. That's awful. But what's even worse is that their lifetime medical expenses are now 10 times higher. And you think, well, insurance is going to cover it. But that's 10 times more sticking and poking and prodding and time in the doctor's office, in the hospital, in the ICU. Oy. I mean, quality of life really stinks. If people slip that far down, it's just, and it's all preventable, Donna. It's all preventable.
Right.
I mean, hey, everybody's going to go. We're all going to check out. But you really don't have to go out that way.
So back when this genetic mutation happened, people weren't eating the standard American diet. Right?
No, I mean, absolutely. You know, I tell my patients, listen, shop on the perimeter of your grocery store, you know, where you've got produce, fresh vegetables, meat, whole grains. But so many people gravitate to the center where food is in boxes or packages or freezer cans, you know, and our diet is just wrong for the metabolic condition called insulin resistance. And even, you know, the Chinese are complaining about the health problems associated with what they call the new affluence diet. Mm-hmm. And it's, of course, not just diet, it's lifestyle too. Mm-hmm. But it's, in a way, it's wonderful because the solutions are pretty simple, mm-hmm. not easy. You know, hey, peace in the Middle East is simple. You know, Jewish people be nice to Muslims. Muslim people be nice to Jewish people. And then peace would break out all over the Middle East. You know, so it's very simple. It's just not easy to do. But when people are sick enough, they find it really easy to address insulin resistance properly. I mean,
and you
we've
also,
known about this. Yeah, go ahead, Donna.
Well, you also have the food that's just has so much pesticides and herbicides, and then, of course, the GMOs, genetically modified.
If you're eating the right kind of carbohydrates and foods, you can get away with a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to have roaches in my house. And I really don't want to have rats in my house, but I especially don't want to have hungry tigers in my house, you know? So eating the standard American diet, you got a hungry tiger watching you every time you get up from the TV to go to the refrigerator. You know, that's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different scale of pestilent problems.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, in New Orleans, we all live with roaches, and we're okay with that, just so you know. They provide entertainment. One of my classmates at Tulane used to shoot him off the wall of his apartment with a BB gun.
Goodness.
Tulane doctors are a little bit odd, just in case you hadn't figured that out yet.
I haven't met many, but...
just as well, probably.
Thanks for letting me know. So,
forewarned.
So why don't we talk about insulin?
Yes. Insulin is a wonderful hormone without which we could not live. It's one of the few hormones that is absolutely essential to life. And insulin is basically, in its most elemental role, an energy storage hormone. Insulin does lots of things in the human body, but its single most important effect is right as we are eating a meal, insulin tells our muscle cells and our fat cells to soak up blood sugar, because that food we're eating is being digested. All the carbohydrates from our broccoli or our potatoes or cauliflower or carrots, it's all made out of sugar strung together. Just like words on a page are made of letters, all carbohydrates, regardless of whether we consider them healthy or not, they're made of sugar. And so our digestive enzymes cut those carbohydrates into sugar, or they get absorbed into our bloodstream. And then insulin tells our muscles and our fat cells, soak up the sugar. And 80% of the carbohydrate that we eat in a meal goes into our muscles particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us energy to run around and do all the things we need to do with our muscles. So insulin.
So that would be glycogen
storage.
Go ahead. Glycogen storage you're talking about?
Well, yeah. Some of the insulin that goes into the muscle is converted to glycogen for storage, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, glycogen is the human version of starch. It's a little fancier. You know, we've got to be fancier than plants. You know, plant has starch in a straight line, and glycogen branches and gets interesting. But basically, glycogen is human starch. Insulin also does lots of other things. But most people think, insulin controls your blood sugar. And it does. And if you have no insulin, you cannot control your blood sugar. And the blood sugar gets so high, it sucks the water out of the brain and puts people into a diabetic coma if there's no insulin. And that's lethal.
Mm-hmm.
So, but insulin does all kinds of other things. Humans store energy mostly as fat. You know, a gram of glycogen is only 4 calories. A gram of fat is 9 calories. So we've got a lot more efficient way to store energy than plants do. And Insulin tells our liver to convert our blood sugar to fat for storage. And insulin does all sorts of other things to help us to store energy. It converts our blood sugar to proteins. It makes new proteins. It keeps you from breaking down old proteins. It keeps you from breaking down old sugar. It keeps you from breaking down old fat. It's a fat storage hormone.
And it turns cholesterol production on as well, correct? Cholesterol production.
Well, yeah. I mean, triglycerides are the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find is that some people, high insulin drives high cholesterol. And that's also associated with high blood sugar, which is a little farther down the line with insulin resistance. I'm sure we'll get there. But cholesterol is basically made out of products of glucose. And if you didn't have glucose, you couldn't make cholesterol. And the cholesterol that's causing problems, the bad cholesterol, is basically made out of sugar, and it's the stuff we're making ourselves. And I imagine we'll get into lipids later, too. I don't want to jump the gun. I know you've got a plan.
No, I like your plan.
Well, thank you, ma'am. So with insulin resistance, the muscles do not efficiently respond to insulin by taking up blood sugar. So when a person is insulin resistant, they have to make more insulin than normal in order to get the message through to the muscles, hey, take up this extra sugar. And so for years and decades, those of us with the genes for insulin resistance, when we have a sugary, starchy meal, we make more insulin than normal. And for years, doctors thought, well, as long as the blood sugar is normal, it doesn't matter. But it does matter. And the reason it matters is all the other things that insulin does in our body that
right.
we were touching on briefly.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, if a person's muscles become so resistant to insulin that they just cannot soak up enough blood sugar to keep your blood sugar from rising above a certain dotted line that we consider high blood sugar, then we call that person diabetes. And that is just the tip of the iceberg for this whole problem with insulin resistance, you see. So when we talk about insulin resistance, we are not talking only about diabetes. That's the end of the line. Of course, the more you know about insulin resistance, the better you can treat diabetes. I'm really happy. I talked to a fellow yesterday who's a type 2 insulin-resistant diabetic. And he's not anymore. I called him a dino. He's a diabetic in name only because now his blood sugar is back down to normal, even though it was high because mm-hmm. he's doing all the right lifestyle things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sweet. That mm-hmm. feels pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Cutting out carbs and sugars, exercising, those kinds of
getting
things.
Getting some sleep, taking some getting mm-hmm. some supplements. And we'll be talking about, basically, I look at four big ways that you can address insulin resistance and turn it into a pussycat. You're taming the tiger and making it a pussycat. But one thing I'd like to say before we get any further is that the release of insulin happens in two different phases, and it's beautifully designed. Our creator is a pretty slick girl or guy, depending on your religious philosophy. But as soon as something sweet touches our tongue tells our brain, which tells our pancreas to release insulin. It's the same way when you're coming to a turn and you're riding your bicycle, you lean into the turn before you actually turn. And so the first phase of insulin release happens within a half an hour, and the second phase is regulated by our blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And the blood sugar itself stimulates the pancreas to release insulin. And this sounds a little puzzling now, but when we get to artificial sweeteners and non-nutritive sweeteners, ooh, it's really important. So
mm-hmm.
I just wanted to throw that out there so who's ever listening has in the back of their mind this little asterisk over sweeteners, and we'll get to it, okay?
Okay. No, that'll be great. We've talked about that some on the show, but
everybody
really
knows they're bad, but I think I got the hookup on why they're bad, at least one of the big reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. So again, anything sweet causes insulin release. What else causes insulin release?
Well, basically, insulin is released, like I said, in two phases. There are lots of things that taste sweet. Hence, we have not only glucose and fructose and maltose and dextrose, but we've got sucralose and saccharin and cyclamates and stevia. There's lots and lots of stuff that tastes sweet. And anything that tastes sweet will trigger a reflex in our tongue to tell our brain, to tell the pancreas to release some insulin into our bloodstream. And then after that sweet stuff has been swallowed, downstream in the small intestine, there are similar taste buds in the small intestine, if you can believe it, and they stimulate release of insulin through the production of a little chemical messenger. And that messenger is mimicked by things like Januvia and Trulicity. And there are some new drugs that stimulate the intestinal taste bud phase of insulin stimulation. And then the big stimulus for insulin is glucose itself on the sweet receptors on the cells of the insulin secreting, insulin making cells in the pancreas. So we have that oral intestinal phase that's kind of a reflex, and then we have glucose itself stimulating the receptors in the pancreas. Now, fructose will do it also. Fructose is a whole other topic of its own. I'm trying not to get distracted and talk too much about fructose. Fructose will stimulate insulin release. The Germans did a study on the ICU. They gave people intravenous fructose to see if they could help diabetics control their blood sugar better, and they proved.
Oh my! Do you mean high fructose? Do you mean high fructose corn syrup fructose, that kind?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. Well, you know, fructose is corn sugar. It's fruit sugar. Fructose is fruit sugar.
Right.
And you know, if you look at table sugar, there's one molecule of glucose stuck to one molecule of fructose, and that's table sugar. Mm-hmm. So table sugar is 50% fructose by itself. And the high fructose corn syrup is about 55% fructose. So it's not a whole lot different from table sugar. But fructose itself is metabolized really differently by the body.
Right.
Wikipedia's got a nice little article. And fructose, your body immediately wants to turn fructose into fat for storage. When you eat fruit, 80% of the fruit sugar you are eating is going to go into fat for storage. Only 20% is converted to glucose.
Mm-hmm.
So people have not really understood that, ever since the American Depression, we've all been told to eat an apple a day, keep the doctor away, and have a lot of fruit, because that was about as sophisticated as their nutritional information was back then. But really, fructose, it stimulates insulin release, which we don't like, and it doesn't raise your blood sugar very much, and it goes into storage as fat. So it's like a triple whammy.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta be a little careful about food in the diet, for real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
go ahead.
Well, people don't realize this, as you said, because, you know, we think that fruits are really healthy to eat, and there are some, you know, excellent vitamins and bioflavonoids and such in fruits, but yes, you are getting that fructose.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, yes. People with insulin resistance are vulnerable to sweet stuff, whether it's table sugar or fruit sugar or even stevia, which we all think is natural and harmless as the day is long, but it hits people with insulin resistance. And what happens is when those of us with insulin resistance, and I include myself in this group, make too much insulin, it gives us high blood pressure. It stimulates our adrenal gland to make too many adrenal steroids, which make us fatter and raise our blood sugar. Our daughters get to puberty early. We make more stomach acid. Insulin acts like growth hormone. In fact, insulin and growth hormone strongly stimulate each other's receptors. Growth hormone is activated to something called insulin-like growth factor. So people with high levels of insulin make more cancers. And when they get a cancer, they don't do as well.
Mm-hmm.
And insulin acts like the hormone aldosterone. So not only is insulin telling the brain to make norepinephrine and raise our blood pressure, it's telling our kidney to save salt and make our blood pressure even higher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it causes the ovaries to make a lot of cysts, giving girls PCOS and PMS. And then it even changes the cells in the ovaries. It's called theca cell metaplasia, and they start making testosterone. And it changes the way men and women process their sex hormones. Men and women both have lots of testosterone relative to the other ones, and testosterone by itself doesn't do a lot. The active form of testosterone is dihydrotestosterone. It's, you know, anywhere from 5 to 12 times more powerful than testosterone, and men are supposed to make that conversion and women are not. But women with insulin resistance do that. And so PCOS, one of the hallmarks, is excessive DHT with facial acne and facial hair and hair loss in the girls. Now, women take testosterone and they convert it to estradiol, which is way more powerful as a feminizing hormone than testosterone is as a masculinizing hormone. And men are not supposed to do this, but men with insulin resistance do. So 40% of men who have an advanced form of insulin resistance called metabolic syndrome have low testosterone and high estrogen because they're converting their testosterone to estrogen. And so it does all kinds of nasty little gender bending. And that's why Bubba had, sound like Bubba with big boobs and a high voice. Bubba had low testosterone. Mm-hmm. I see some Bubbas around here in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Insulin is pro-inflammatory, too. High levels of insulin. Some of the docs at Laval University in Quebec are really looking at insulin as a predictor of heart attack and stroke, and they have it as one of the three signs of, you know, high risk for a vascular event. And what's interesting is the other two signs are also related to high insulin, high triglycerides, and a bad cholesterol pattern. So insulin is pro-inflammatory. It stimulates the immune system to make inflammatory cytokines. It damages the lining of our arteries, and it causes mischief there. So way back in 1988, Professor Reeven at Stanford put this together, and he called it the metabolic syndrome. And that's a constellation of overweight, high blood triglycerides and cholesterol, often low good cholesterol and high bad cholesterol, high blood pressure, and then trouble controlling the blood sugar. And all of these are related to insulin resistance. They're all due to the unopposed actions of high insulin, and they're all preventable. So, you want to talk about how to prevent it, or you want to take some questions?
Well, we can take some questions if there are callers that would like to call in. And, Dove, you want to give out the phone number, please?
826-7771. That's directly to the studio. You can ask the doctor on the air here any questions you have, or 866-275-1112. That's our toll-free number.
So we have this this sense insulin resistance. And so insulin keeps going higher and higher because the cells are not able to receive the insulin or activate anymore.
Right.
Correct?
Right. The insulin connects, but it doesn't trigger the response it's trying to trigger.
Right.
There's a really nice paper by Zhao and Keating in 2007 describing the molecular biology of this. So Z-H-A-O, Zhao and Keating. If you really want to get deep into the biology of it. But
now,
suffice to say what you said, that was good.
Well, so I have a number of patients that come to me with type 2 diabetes, and their doctors have actually put them on insulin. So do you want to talk about that?
There's some smart guys. Yeah, there are smart guys who think that's a good idea, and I don't. I go to grand rounds at the Department of Division of Endocrinology here at the university every week because this is where I learn what everybody's thinking and saying. And the endocrinologists around here are calling it double diabetes. When somebody has insulin resistance and they need insulin on top of that. You know, it's the problem is that when you give these folks, well, let me back up. Let me back up just a minute, Don. I'm sorry. I see two types of type 2 diabetics, and there's one group whose pancreas, after years and years of making high levels of insulin, the pancreas just quits.
It's exhausted.
And there's a fair amount of research into the genetics of a pancreas that's just going to quit. And so I have obviously tests in patients who have type 2 diabetes, but they just don't have any insulin. And you kind of call it type 1 diabetes now because they need insulin. They've got to. They can't make their own anymore. But I have a larger cadre of patients who have high insulin already, and it's just they're making tons of insulin, but it's just not enough to control. And when you give them even more insulin, you know, you're painting the wall and you're not fixing the roof. Honest to goodness, you got to fix the roof for these people.
Right.
So that was a very astute question. Bring some more out. That was a good one.
Well, I mean, all of the issues that insulin causes, it's not just about blood sugar balance, as you were saying.
Well, in fact, when I was, I'm 100 years old. When I was a resident back in the late 70s, early 80s, we used to think that all of the ills of diabetes came from high sugar. And there was an article, an editorial in JAMA in 2012, that said maybe as much as 20% of the ills of diabetes come from high sugar, but the rest are from other stuff. And the other stuff includes high levels of insulin and inflammatory products and all the the lipid problems. So we are really learning that it is not just about the sugar, but don't try telling it to a 60-year-old MD because he learned it differently. The hope is in the young ones. So when I have a patient come in with diabetes, like this fellow I saw yesterday, the first thing I want to do is say, okay, what's your fasting glucose and what's your fasting insulin? And that's a great question. 20 years ago, a professor at Laval wrote an editorial in the European Journal of Endocrinology saying, is it time to measure insulin? Duh. And 20 years later, most guys are still not doing it routinely. It's so sad. Mm-hmm. It just takes so long to change a cognitive structure that got inculcated into us in the 70s and 80s. Oh, it takes so long to change a guy's mind. But my man had tons of insulin. Hell, he had too much. He's burning up his blood vessels. So awesome. I know it's going to work to give him the right diet, to work on his lifestyle, to give him the supplements he needs, and talk about herbs or drugs to improve his situation. And so I've even gotten guys off insulin. You know, some folks will come in and their doc put them on insulin and their A1C came down to, below 7. That's the average blood sugar for 3 months. And so everybody was happy, but I'm not happy because the patient doesn't feel well and he's injecting insulin and he's got other problems that have been addressed. Oh, your lipids are bad. Well, let me give you a statin drug. And, oh, I'm sorry, your muscles hurt and your liver enzymes are up, but that's the price of admission. And it doesn't have to be that way. You know that better than most people being a naturopath.
Right, absolutely. Well, let's talk.
So when we treat these people, the goal is to improve insulin sensitivity and just reduce the need to make insulin. That's all it takes.
What do you feel is the most important aspect to improve insulin sensitivity?
Well, to improve insulin sensitivity, probably the single most important is using your muscles. Mm-hmm. Because there are stacks of physiological research into muscle mechanics that show when you use muscles, they get hungry. They want sugar, so they upregulate the production of everything you want. They upregulate insulin receptors. They upregulate glucose transporters. They upregulate the trafficking proteins that move the glucose transporter to the cell membrane to suck up the blood sugar. And cells start burning fat, too. And the muscles usually when you have a lazy, indolent skeletal muscle, like mine have been at one time or another in my life, they are very snooty and they only want to burn glucose, thank you very much. But when you go out there and use them and make them work for a living, they'll take whatever energy they can get. So they start burning fat and you name it. So the big way to improve a person's insulin sensitivity is to do about 30 minutes of physical activity every day. And really that's all it takes, Donna. There's a really nice PBS, BBC production by Dr. Mosley titled The Truth About Exercise, and you can get it on Vimeo and other websites, and I try to get all my patients to watch it because he talks about different forms of exercise. He quotes or he visits a researcher in the north of England who shows that there are five different genetic programs. And some people can go to a gym for a half an hour a day and do brilliantly, and other people can go to the same gym for an hour a day and it doesn't do them a damn bit of good. And it turns out that these people who don't do well doing aerobic and weights do brilliantly doing burst exercise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's some really cool stuff. The Swedes
interval exercise or burst exercise.
Well, it's actually even shorter than interval. It's so easy, nobody believes it'll work. But they show his glucose and insulin curves before and after. Holy moly. All you do is you sit on this stupid exercise bike, you pedal for a couple minutes to warm up, and then you sprint like the devil himself was after you for 30 seconds. And after 30 seconds, you just pedal slowly and get your heart rate below 100, and then you do it again for 30 seconds. And you do it 3 times a week. And what they found when they did his, they tested Dr. Mosley before he did this and then after 4 weeks of doing this. So that's 12 minutes of exercise. 12 minutes! And his blood sugar control was not bad in the first place and it remained the same. But it took half as much insulin to keep it there after 12 minutes of exercise. And that's right in line with a Swedish study that was published in JAMA back around 2008, maybe, as a letter. And they took a bunch of these Swedes and they gave them sugar to drink and they measured their blood sugar and their blood insulin afterwards. And then they made them act like Americans. They went from over 9,000 steps a day to less than 2,000 steps a day. So they got in their little beep-beep cars and they drove everywhere instead of walking or biking like them good Swedes do, you know, the sinister of the Vikings. And their blood sugar control was the same, but they had doubled the amount of insulin it required to do it. So this is exactly the same finding mirror image that they did with Mosley. And it's just so powerful in convincing me that this is the right approach for improving insulin sensitivity. Now, the other way to improve insulin sensitivity is to get enough sleep. I just went to a grand rounds given by Professor Moss from Cornell, who is now running a sleep business. He's an old Oprah guest. Has a picture of him in bed with Oprah. You can't beat that for a sleep specialist. And Dr. Moss absolutely correctly points out that the average American really needs 8 hours of sleep. And he gave all the chapter and verse for it. But there's a professor in Chicago, Eve Van Couther, and she has done really good science, you know, doing fancy hormone assays. And when we get too little sleep, which I think is probably less than 8 hours a night, we become really insulin resistant, and it just accelerates the whole business. So I've been communicating with a patient today, a great kid, and she does everything right, except she's only getting 5 hours a night because she has to get up to exercise 2 hours every morning, and she's doing sweeteners, and that's why she can't lose weight. So the improving insulin sensitivity, sleep and exercise. Take good care of the body. Another way to do it is chromium.
Oh, I think we lost you. Are you still
there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. It just went off for a second.
Good.
But I have a question back to the burst exercising. So I just wanted to clarify for the listeners. So 30 seconds after you've warmed up for about 3 minutes on the bicycle, 30 seconds of sprint And then you allow your heart rate to go below 100. And then how many times do you do that for? Just until 12 minutes, or you do
No, just twice.
Just twice.
So two 60 seconds, 3 days a week.
Wow.
It is amazing. Now, it kind of depends on what your genetic makeup is.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
But let me see. I've got, let me give you guys the web address for this Vimeo movie. Mm-hmm. You want me to do that, Donna? I just looked it up
on
the internet.
That'd be great.
It's, of course, the usual https://Vimeo, Vimeo, V like Victor, I-M-E-O, .com/518-36895. You search The Truth About Exercise. Mm-hmm. And it's a 54-minute show. And some of it's boring, but most of it is, for me at least, because I'm a big geek, riveting. Just riveting.
Thank you. That's a wonderful tip there. Very good. So I interrupted you. So the third most, we've got the burst training and exercise in general. We've got getting enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're going to talk about diet.
Well, yes.
What's next?
Diet. What diet does is it does not improve insulin sensitivity. It reduces the need to produce insulin, which is really important.
Yes.
So, you know, we're looking at, you know, making a person stronger to handle the load, but giving them a lighter load they got to carry, right?
Right.
So the best diet for insulin resistance really can be described in three ways. One is a low glycemic index diet.
Mm-hmm.
The second is slowly accessible glucose. And the third, and really important, is low insulinemic index. And I will need to explain that. So let's talk about these. I think most people have heard of the glycemic index. It was developed in 1981 by a guy named Jenkins to help diabetics. He wanted to find out when you eat a certain food, how much does it raise your blood sugar? So he can give you more insulin. And we know that foods that don't raise your blood sugar that much generally are helpful for people with insulin resistance. But you see, the glycemic index is about sugar and glucose, and insulin resistance is more about insulin. So you have to look at something else. The second thing to look at is when you are eating your food, you know, a meal is made of three big types of food, protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And low carbohydrate, you know, the carbohydrate is the key part for insulin resistance. And there's a kind of a incorrect use of a term. Everybody talks about a low carbohydrate diet, thanks to Dr. Atkins. And Atkins was really close to nirvana on this. But it's important to know that we should really get 40%, maybe even 50% of our daily calories from carbohydrates. And for an insulin resistant person, the key is not how many carbs you're eating, it's what kind of carbs.
I'm sorry,
and
what
again,
was the percentage?
What
was the percentage?
Kind of carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. What was the percentage you said?
About 40 to 50%, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Campbell, who wrote the China study,
mm-hmm.
Is a really good nutritionist, and that's his number, and he's probably right. He's probably
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
But the key thing is what kind of carbohydrates. We want to eat carbohydrates that when we chew them up and swallow them and they come into our digestive juices, they release sugar into our bloodstream slowly.
Slowly,
and
yes.
So
over
the
sustained
French
period.
Call mm-hmm. this, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly accessible glucose, or SAGs, and you've heard them called slow carbs, and I think that's a great way to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you eat a slow carb, you don't have to make that much insulin.
Okay.
When you eat a fast carb, it just releases the sugar all at once. Bam! You know, whether you're having white bread or sugar, it's actually the same to your body. White bread and sugar are exactly the same glycemic index.
Right.
It's embarrassing. Right. And it's just like
pasta.
Putting kerosene.
Pasta.
It's like putting gasoline into a kerosene lantern. It just releases all the energy, bam, and burns you up.
Mm-hmm. pasta, potatoes, those kinds of things?
Pasta is somewhat better than white bread, and they don't even know why. But, yeah, white potatoes, white bread, white rice, sugar, starchy stuff.
Fruits.
And fruit, really, especially preserved fruit. Oh, my God, like those cling peaches we love and the pineapples mm-hmm. and the syrup, yum. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, no, those are bad news. But fruit I have on my big caution list.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want to eat are vegetables, the green, yellow, orange, red, and purple vegetables. Those guys are slow carbs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third key.
What about legumes? What about legumes?
They're kind of starchy. So I let my people have a legume like lima beans or English peas or peanuts. I figure a serving a day, no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this, you know, like basmati rice or quinoa, you know, a serving a day, no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell if it's a big deal by how people do. You know, if they're doing everything just right and it's, you know, not quite working, that's when you know you need to find something else or tighten up a little bit. But the third feature of a healthy diet for those of us with insulin resistance is something most people have never heard of. It's called the low insulinemic index. This is work that a group of Aussies down in Melbourne thought about it back in 94 and published it, and there are over a dozen articles now. The question is, when you eat a given food, how much does that food raise your insulin? Because insulin is what's kicking our butts. And a healthy diet doesn't require too much insulin to be made, so it will be a low insulinemic diet. And the sweeteners, non-nutritive sweeteners, even though they've got no calories, they kick up insulin big time. So they've got, like stevia or Splenda, have a zero glycemic index, but it's got a huge insulinemic index. And so that's why we need to shun those sweeteners.
Right, and they're so much sweeter than sugar. So,
oh, yeah.
So it's yeah. You're saying it's increasing insulin release even more.
Well, it does. Mm-hmm. You know, mostly they cut the, you know, like sucralose is like 20 times or 40 times sweeter than sugar, so they cut
mm-hmm.
it. You know, they make it last longer. Man, the first one's free, you know, I say. And they also have a bit of an aftertaste, so they got to be careful with that stuff. But, you know, the key thing is that for years and years, we were all told it's all about calories. And, you know, calories are important. Because you know, if I go out and eat 5,000 calories a day, unless I'm swimming like, you know, the man dolphin, what's his name, who won all the gold medals, then this generation's Mark Spitz,
mm-hmm.
Mike Phelps, you know, unless you're just burning off massive amounts of calories, you're going to gain weight. But what Atkins figured out in the 60s was figured out by a doctor named Harvey in the 1860s and a French gourmet in the 1790s is when you eat a lot of sweet stuff, even if you're not eating a lot of calories, your body's going to save the energy. You know, once you really get into the history of this, it's pretty fascinating who else has thought of this over the years.
Mm.
And thank God we got the internet now, because they didn't in those days and things got lost.
Mm-hmm. So, very good. We only have actually a few more minutes left. I know. We certainly didn't cover our other topic, so we'll just have to do that another time if you're willing.
I'll invite you back. I'd love to.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. So, well, was there another? We talked about improving insulin resistance, improving sensitivity.
Yes.
Was there something else that you were going to mention?
Supplements. Herbs. Yeah. The supplement is chromium. People with insulin resistance mm-hmm. have been shown to lose chromium, and chromium is really important for the process of hoovering blood sugar into the muscle cells that is weakened with insulin resistance. So losing that little piece of metal is really a double whammy. I mean, it may be just a little piece of metal, but so is my car key. If I don't have my car key, I can't even get in my car out of the rain, you know? And so chromium supplementation, a lot of people do well with chromium picolinate, 1,000 micrograms, which is 1 milligram a day. and you really don't absorb picolinate very well, so you have to take a lot. And then other companies make a little aqueous chromium that is chromium trichloride, and one drop or two drops a day on that. Wonderful. It really helps a lot of people. And the last step is kind of nutraceuticals. And among them are berberine, which there's been a lot of research in the People's Republic about berberine. And as best I can tell, berberine and metformin work very much in a similar way. And the People's Republic show that they complement each other. So if a person's doing okay on metformin but not well and you give them berberine, they do just that much better, and vice versa. So it's kind of like 1 + 1 = 3 if you put them together. There are other drugs, the glitazone drugs, but they just don't work as well because they don't really repair the problem. They emphasize the good aspects of insulin, but they also emphasize some of the bad aspects of insulin. So they make people gain weight, and they retain fluid and push them into heart failure. And it's just not that great. Metformin and berberine seem to get into the real cause of the problem and bolster it. So that the Harvard guys give people metformin to help them lose weight, which is awesome.
Yeah. Now, berberine is one of the active ingredients in Oregon grapefruit and also golden seal. Most people have heard of golden seal. Now, can you just, we're really going to have to go, but just quickly tell us about metformin, because so many people are on it.
Sure. Metformin is a poorly understood drug that seems to help the trafficking proteins in the cell. The problem with metformin is that if you have a bad diet and you take metformin, you get the same symptoms as a person with lactose intolerance, because the metformin keeps you from digesting and absorbing your sugar. So people get gastrointestinal complaints and cramps and gas and bloating and diarrhea and sweats. And because of that, doctors tell people to take their metformin with food. And the reason that works is when you take metformin with food, you absorb hardly any of it. You cut it down to only about 40% or less of what you've actually taken. So metformin's a great drug, but it doesn't do well if you're on a bad diet, and it should be taken about an hour before a meal. This is the way the PDR used to describe it 15 years ago, but now they've changed just out of usage, and something good has been lost.
Well, unfortunately, we are completely out of time. Thank you so much, Dr. McDaniel. It's really wonderful having you here and such an informative show. So,
Dr. Kaplan, it's been a complete pleasure talking to you. Donna, you're a good egg. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, well, we're going to have you come back. And we have another show coming up with Richard, One World. So thanks for listening to Health Talk. And we'll see you on the first and third Mondays from 12 to 1. Ahui ho.